Namaste. Welcome back. We continue in chapter 28 of The Life Divine. To live a life divine, first you have to be. No longer living in the superficies of existence, you have to live in the depths of your true core being. The essence is that reality, Brahman, which in the terminology that Sri Aurobindo most loves is termed Sat. One must be conscious of one's existence. One must unroll the power that is innate in true conscious existence and express it. And to express it means to experience it within this consciousness, and all experience to this conscious being is delight. So if we are to understand ourselves, to be ourselves, to our root, then Sat-Chit-Ananda, existence, consciousness, and bliss, must be brought down through a growing awareness into the actualities of our lives. That consciousness in which these great infinities are expressed is the supramental. That supramental consciousness embraces the infinity and gives harmonic expression to it without losing the fundamental unity on which it is based. So, completeness of being would mean completeness of being everywhere, but beginning with the self, with the individual. The perfection of the individual is our first command. But that is not sufficient. We must become universal. We must cosmicize to bring into universal expression, into oneness with the all around, what is the truth of our nature, recognizing the truth of all nature, seeing only that one everywhere. And where does this universe, where does this individual come from, but from that transcendence? So Sri Aurobindo has called us to remember that from that unknowable is this manifest Sat-Chit-Ananda, which is omnipresent. Remember, the first book of The Life Divine is called The Omnipresent Reality. And it is the perfected expression of that in a universal individual as a tempering of the timeless in time. That is the intended function of the realized soul. So, to be able to do that, of course, we have first to go inside to find who this being is. And living within is the first desideratum. So we pick it up there. He's just made a reference to the Katha Upanishad there. And again, tracing out in a way in philosophic discourse what are the elements of his own personal life. This movement of going inward and living inward is a difficult task to lay upon the normal consciousness of the human being, yet there is no other way of self-finding. The materialistic thinker, erecting an opposition between the extrovert and the introvert, holds up the extrovert attitude for acceptance as the only safety. To go inward is to enter into darkness or emptiness or to lose the balance of the consciousness and become morbid. It is from outside that such inner life as one can construct is created, and its health is assured only by a strict reliance on its wholesome and nourishing outer sources. The balance of the personal mind and life can only be secured by a firm support on external reality, for the material world is the sole fundamental reality. This may be true for the physical man, the born extrovert, who feels himself to be a creature of outward nature, made by her and dependent on her. He would lose himself if he went inward. For him, there is no inner being, no inner living. But the introvert of this distinction also has not the inner life. He is not a seer of the true inner self and of inner things, but the small mental man, who looks superficially inside himself and sees there not his spiritual self, but his life ego, his mind ego, and becomes unhealthily preoccupied with the movements of this little pitiful dwarf creature. The idea or experience of an inner darkness when looking inwards is the first reaction of a mentality which has lived always on the surface and has no realized inner existence. It has only a constructed internal experience which builds on the outside world for the materials of its being. You may remember that Bertrand Russell, the materialistic philosopher of the middle of the 20th century, and a bit earlier, said that he had attempted meditation once, and when he looked inside, he saw only darkness. And so he came rushing back out and said, no, 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 only this world is valid, only this world is real. One wonders if Sri Aurobindo is playing a little with Bertrand here. But to those into whose composition there has entered the power of a more inner living, the movement of going within and living within brings not a darkness or dull emptiness, but an enlargement, a rush of new experience, a greater vision, a larger capacity, an extended life, infinitely more real and various than the first pettiness of the life constructed for itself by our normal physical humanity. A joy of being which is larger and richer than any delight in existence that the outer vital man or the surface mental man can gain by their dynamic vital force and activity or subtlety and expansion of the mental existence. Again, the biographical placement in the early 1910s when Sri Aurobindo was first in Pondicherry of Mother's harmonic arrival in Pondicherry and her working with him with her background in what we now know as Lurianic Kabbalah, etc. This experience of an inner universe which becomes available to one broadens, expands, greatens, deepens every aspect of life. And with the expansion, as he says here, with the enlargement comes a greater experience of delight, no longer a trickle, no longer a joy here and there, lighting up an otherwise placid life, but something that is rich and many-sided. And this idea of a joy which is larger and richer. Again, he translated so beautifully in his rendering of the Taittiriya Upanishad in the Brahmanandavali, section 2, chapter 8. You want to read that. A silence, an entry into a wide or even immense or infinite emptiness, is part of the inner spiritual experience. Of this silence and void, the physical mind has a certain fear. The small, superficially active, thinking or vital mind, a shrinking from it or dislike. For it confuses the silence with mental and vital incapacity, and the void with cessation or non-existence. But this silence is the silence of the spirit, which is the condition of a greater knowledge, power, and bliss. And this emptiness is the emptying of the cup of our natural being, a liberation of it from its turbid contents, so that it may be filled with the wine of God. It is the passage, not into non-existence, but to a greater existence. Even when the being turns towards cessation, it is a cessation not in non-existence, but into some vast ineffable of spiritual being, or the plunge into the incommunicable superconscience of the Absolute. This again takes us back to the earliest chapters of The Life Divine, where Sri Aurobindo takes up the different positions of the Upanishads. The Brihadaranyaka does not agree with the Chandogya, does not agree with the Taittiriya. They all have different views of what is the beginning of the universe. But Sri Aurobindo says the salient feature of all these perspectives is that beyond all that we can touch, see, think, conceive, register in our consciousness is an unknowable which exceeds even the positive formulation of itself as being. So what there is beyond sat, you can say asat, but that thing, that reality, escapes all formulation, even the positive formulation, as true being. So, when we take this passage from the finite to the infinite, from darkness to light, asatoma sadgamaya, from non-being to true being, this is the journey that we make. From the non-existence, the relative small superficial existence, when we are identified with flexible fragmentary nature, to the essential reality of that spiritual being which escapes all definition, exceeds all naming. That is an absolute. In fact, this inward turning and movement is not an imprisonment in personal self. It is the first step towards a true universality. It brings to us the truth of our external as well as the truth of our internal existence. So true being is never confined simply to the inexpressible absolute, but posits itself as an individual, but an individual expressed within the context of a vast universe. For this inner living can extend itself and embrace the universal life. It can contact, penetrate, englobe the life of all with a much greater reality and dynamic force than is in our surface consciousness at all possible. Our utmost universalization on the surface is a poor and limping endeavor. It is a construction, a make-believe, and not the real thing. For in our surface consciousness, we are bound to separation of consciousness from others and wear the fetters of the ego. In modern psychology, this is the whole problem of inner subjectivity. How can I know what that person thinks and feels? Well, in a larger consciousness, one is that other being. Knowledge comes from identity. Soul, penetrating soul, self, only, posited everywhere. There, our very selflessness becomes more often than not a subtle form of selfishness, or turns into a large affirmation of our ego. Content with our pose of altruism, we do not see that it is a veil for the imposition of our individual self, our ideas, our mental and vital personality, our need of ego enlargement upon the others whom we take up into our expanded orbit. So far as we really succeed in living for others, it is done by an inner spiritual force of love and sympathy. But the power and field of effectuality of this force in us are small. The psychic movement that prompts it is incomplete, its action often ignorant, because there is contact of mind and heart, but our being does not embrace the being of others as ourselves. An external unity with others must always be an outward joining and association of external lives with a minor inner result. The mind and heart attach their movements to this common life and the beings whom we meet there. But the common external life remains the foundation. The inward constructed unity, or so much of it as can persist in spite of mutual ignorance and discordant egoisms, conflict of minds, conflict of hearts, conflict of vital temperaments, conflict of interests, is a partial and insecure superstructure. This is the general human condition, isn't it? Whenever we are able to combine our efforts with others in the superficial parts of our nature, the external mind, life, the shell of our physical beings, etc., it's a commerce of a limited, constructed kind with no real reach, and any arrangement is imperfect to begin with and certain to dissolve and reconstitute. So he contrasts that with the kind of society that he wishes to come into being based on true spiritual realization. The spiritual consciousness, the spiritual life, reverses this principle of building. It bases its action in the collective life upon an inner experience and inclusion of others in our own being, an inner sense and reality of oneness. The spiritual individual acts out of that sense of oneness, which gives him immediate and direct perception of the demand of self on other self, the need of the life, the good, the work of love and sympathy that can truly be done. A realization of spiritual unity, a dynamization of the intimate consciousness of one being, of one self in all beings, can alone found and govern by its truth the action of the divine life. So, this is an invitation to those who were with Sri Aurobindo for the remaining years of his life to constitute in the collective life of the ashram a willed endeavor to manifest this harmony based on spiritual realization. In the Gnostic or divine being, in the Gnostic life, there will be a close and complete consciousness of the self of others, a consciousness of their mind, life, physical being, which are felt as if they were one's own. The Gnostic being will act not out of a surface sentiment of love and sympathy or any similar feeling, but out of this close mutual consciousness, this intimate oneness. All his action in the world will be enlightened by a truth of vision of what has to be done, a sense of the will of the divine reality in him, which is also the divine reality in others. And it will be done for the divine in others and the divine in all, for the effectuation of the truth of purpose of the all, as seeing the light of the highest consciousness, and in the way and by the steps through which it must be effectuated in the power of the super nature. So this truth of vision, Ritta Chit, that which is conscious of the truth and orders it in ample expression, means that it must have a dynamic realization in life. It can't simply be an inner reality that we experience in the interior portions of our being but find no expression outside. It must be fully expressed, and not only in ourselves but in the collective life, the material life of the social body. So we can see that the ashram in the early 40s was an important experiment, a laboratory in which these various forces were coming together, these possibilities articulating themselves, Sri Aurobindo envisioning what could happen with the enlightenment at the center of the organization, and as it spreads and manifests, densifies, concretizes, and then boldly proclaims a new life possible for humanity. He continues now. The Gnostic being finds himself not only in his own fulfillment, which is the fulfillment of the divine being and will in him, but in the fulfillment of others. His universal individuality effectuates itself in the movement of the all in all beings towards its greater becoming. And again, remember, just to touch upon it again, that Sri Aurobindo carries the idea of the divine in Sanskrit as expressed in the word Brahman back to its root, brah, which means that which expands, which grows. Brahman then to him is not a static reality, but very much a dynamic reality, a dynamism based on the silent eternity from within, but expressive constantly in endless growth. That is the purpose of the universe. He sees, the Gnostic being, he sees a divine working everywhere. What goes out from him into the sum of that divine working, from the inner light, will, force that works in him, is his action. There is no separative ego in him to initiate anything. It is the transcendent and universal that moves out through his universalized individuality into the action of the universe. As he does not live for a separate ego, so too he does not live for the purpose of any collective ego. He lives in and for the divine in himself, in and for the divine in the collectivity, in and for the divine in all beings. This universality in action, organized by the all-seeing will in the sense of the realized oneness of all, is the law of his divine living. So we see here the spiritually realized cosmic individual seeing itself, himself, herself, all self, in each self, in all selves, all in one, and one in all. So how can that being act in a way that is intentionally harmful? Rather, it builds harmony in its action, in its pursuit of experience in the world. It is then this spiritual fulfillment of the urge to individual perfection and an inner completeness of being that we mean first when we speak of a divine life. It is the first essential condition of a perfected life on earth. And we are therefore right in making the utmost possible individual perfection our first supreme business. The perfection of the spiritual and pragmatic relation of the individual with all around him is our second preoccupation. The solution of this second desideratum lies in a complete universality and oneness with all life upon earth, which is the other concomitant result of an evolution into the Gnostic consciousness and nature. But there still remains the third desideratum, a new world, a change in the total life of humanity, or, at the least, a new perfected collective life in the earth nature. This calls for the appearance not only of isolated, evolved individuals acting in the unevolved mass, but of many Gnostic individuals forming a new kind of beings and a new common life superior to the present individual and common existence. So we see here the three elements of a divine life. First, the perfection of the individual all the way to the core. The second, spiritual solidarity with all, which will give heart to all those who love the earth and the world. And the third, a transformed society. So personal transformation in oneness with all leads to social transformation. A collective life of this kind must obviously constitute itself on the same principle as the life of the Gnostic individual. As in the individual, so in the collective. In our present human existence, there is a physical collectivity held together by the common physical life fact and all that arises from it. Community of interests, a common civilization and culture, a common social law, an aggregate mentality, an economic association, the ideals, emotions, endeavors of the collective ego, with the strand of individual ties and connections running through the whole and helping to keep it together. Or, where there is a difference in these things, opposition, conflict, a practical accommodation or an organized compromise is enforced by the necessity of living together, there is erected a natural or a constructed order. This would not be the Gnostic divine way of collective living. For there, what would bind and hold all together would be not the fact of life creating a sufficiently united social consciousness, but a common consciousness consolidating a common life. Look when you can at the last hymn in the Rig Veda, calling for a common mind, a common life, etc. Thousands of years ago, there was this insight that we take this radiant truth that we perceive there and we establish it here, here with us, and then radiate it out happily to all around. Shall we do it? all will be united by the evolution of the truth consciousness in them. In the changed way of being which this consciousness would bring about in them, they will feel themselves to be embodiments of a single self, souls of a single reality, illumined and motived by a fundamental unity of knowledge, actuated by a fundamental unified will and feeling. A life expressing the spiritual truth would find through them its own natural forms of becoming. An order there would be, for truth of oneness creates its own order, ritta. A law or laws of living there might be, but these would be self-determined. They would be an expression of the truth of a spiritually united being and the truth of a spiritually united life. The whole formation of the common existence would be a self-building of the spiritual forces that must work themselves out spontaneously in such a life. These forces would be received inwardly by the inner being and expressed or self-expressed in a native harmony of idea and action and purpose. An increasing mechanization, a standardization, a fixing of all into a common mold in order to ensure harmony is the mental method, but that would not be the law of this living. There would be a considerable free diversity between different Gnostic communities. Each would create its own body of the life of the Spirit. There would be, too, a considerable free diversity in the self-expression of the individuals of a single community. But this free diversity would not be a chaos or create any discord, for a diversity of one truth of knowledge and one truth of life would be a correlation and not an opposition. Correlation, a state of shared relation. So here we see Sri Aurobindo, without so much stating it, seeing that these Gnostic collectivities, an enlightened individual or a cluster of enlightened individuals, aware of truth, expressing truth, the delight of being all around, would each find different expressions around the world, not simply in Pondicherry, not simply in the Sri Aurobindo ashram, but expressive in the life of humanity in many places. All would be different. They would all express the variety and the richness of possibility that exist within the infinite, but all would be, in a sense, already related to each other, coming from the same self. Oneness, harmony, correlation, not opposition. In a Gnostic consciousness, he writes, there would be no ego insistence on personal idea, and no push or clamor of personal will and interest. There would be instead the unifying sense of a common truth in many forms, a common self in many consciousnesses and bodies. There would be a universality and plasticity which saw and expressed the one in many figures of itself and worked out oneness in all diversities as the inherent law of the truth consciousness and its truth of nature. And we have adumbrations of this in all of India's rich spiritual traditions, beginning with the Veda, coming forth in the Upanishads, expressing itself more roundly in the Bhagavad Gita, and going dynamically after social positive change and expression fully in life in the field of the Tantra. But here Sri Aurobindo brings all these lines of expression and possibility into this beautiful vision which he expresses. A single consciousness force, Chit-Shakti, of which all would be aware and see themselves as its instruments, would act through all and harmonize their action together. So this is the real thing. When one lives in the consciousness of the Mahashakti, then there isn't any need to seek for accord. It is spontaneous. It is automatic. The Gnostic being would feel a single consonant force of supernature acting in all. This is not Prakriti. This is Paraprakriti. This is the higher nature. The higher triadic action, Sat-Chit-Ananda, expressed through the supramental in matter, life, and mind. He would accept its formation in himself and obey or use the knowledge and power it gave him for the divine work, but he would be under no urge or compulsion to set the power and knowledge in him against the power and knowledge of others, or affirm himself as an ego striving against other egos. For the spiritual self has its own inalienable joy and plenitude, inviolable in all conditions, its own infinity of truth of being, that it feels always in fullness, whatever may be the outward formulation. So in other words, there's no delight as a prize at the end of an endeavor. Delight is constant. Felicity is unceasing, and one acts from delight, not to grab this for oneself in opposition to another's reach. There is no sense of discord and competition of that nature. The truth of the spirit within would not depend on a particular formation. It would have no need, therefore, to struggle for any particular outward formulation and self-affirmation. Forms would arise of themselves plastically, in suitable relation to other formulations, and each in its own place in the whole formulation. So, this is different. This is not acting from nishkama, from freedom from desire. This is motived from a different spiritual source. Truth of Gnostic consciousness and being, establishing itself, can find its harmony with all other truth of being around it. A spiritual or Gnostic being would feel his harmony with the whole Gnostic life around him, whatever his position in the whole. According to his place in it, he would know how to lead or to rule, but also how to subordinate himself. Both would be to him an equal delight. For the spirit's freedom, because it is eternal, self-existent, and inalienable, can be felt as much in service and willing subordination and adjustment with other selves as in power and rule. One is reminded of Sri Aurobindo's own person, august, as magnificent as the Himalayas, and yet, at the right moment, he would use the towel last. Mother would assign him the duty of carrying water to water the plants, and he happily worked. An inner spiritual freedom can accept its place in the truth of an inner spiritual hierarchy, as well as in the truth, not incompatible with it, of a fundamental spiritual equality. This is something that defies the logic of the human mind, that one can live in the fundamental equality oneself everywhere, but that does not abolish the functioning of that same spirit working in various manifestations. And there is a particular instrument in the universal symphony that a soul is assigned to play, plays that, recognizing still its identity with the self common to all. So a hierarchy and equality may be opposite principles in political science, but in spiritual reality, they are coordinate. It is this self-arrangement of truth, a natural order of the spirit, that would exist in a common life of different degrees and stages of the evolving Gnostic being. Unity is the basis of the Gnostic consciousness. Mutuality, the natural result of its direct awareness of oneness in diversity. Harmony, the inevitable power of the working of its force. Unity, mutuality, and harmony must therefore be the inescapable law of a common or collective Gnostic life. What forms it might take would depend upon the will of evolutionary manifestation of the supernature, but this would be its general character and principle. So, the individual seeds the spread of light into society, and we find there, we establish there, unity, which is oneness, mutuality, which is shared reciprocity, and harmony, which means that the parts are happily connected in the whole. So I think this is a grand place to put a bookmark, and we'll continue with this final chapter of The Life Divine next time we meet. But we continue with the section from Savitri that we began last time. It's so beautiful, and it continues in its inspired flow. This is in Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 15, The Kingdoms of the Greater Knowledge. There distance was his own huge spirit's extent. Delivered from the fictions of the mind, time's triple dividing step baffled no more. Its inevitable and continuous stream, the long flow of its manifesting course, was held in spirit's single wide regard. A universal beauty showed its face. The invisible, deep-fraught significances, here sheltered behind form's insensible screen, uncovered to him their deathless harmony and the key to the wonder book of common things. In their uniting law stood up revealed the multiple measures of the upbuilding force, the lines of the world geometer's technique, the enchantments that uphold the cosmic web, and the magic underlying simple shapes. On peaks where silence listens with still heart to the rhythmic meters of the rolling worlds, he served the sessions of the triple fire. On the rim of two continents of slumber and trance, he heard the ever-unspoken reality's voice awaken revelation's mystic cry, the birthplace found of the sudden, infallible word, and lived in the rays of an intuitive sun. Absolved from the ligaments of death and sleep, He rode the lightning seas of cosmic mind and crossed the ocean of original sound. On the last step to the supernal birth, he trod along extinction's narrow edge near the high verges of eternity and mounted the gold ridge of the world dream between the Slayer and the Savior fires. The belt he reached of the unchanging truth met borders of the inexpressible light and thrilled with the presence of the ineffable. Above him he saw the flaming hierarchies, the wings that fold around created space, the sun-eyed guardians and the golden sphinx, and the tiered plains and the immutable lords. A wisdom waiting on omniscience sat voiceless in a vast passivity. It judged not, measured not, nor strove to know, but listened for the veiled all-seeing thought and the burden of a calm transcendent voice. He had reached the top of all that can be known. His sight surpassed creation's head and base. Ablaze, the triple heavens revealed their suns. The obscure abyss exposed its monstrous rule. All but the ultimate mystery was his field. Almost the unknowable disclosed its rim. His self's infinities began to emerge. The hidden universes cried to him. Eternities called to eternities, sending their speechless message still remote. Arisen from the marvel of the depths, and burning from the superconscious heights, and sweeping in great horizontal gyres, a million energies joined and were the one. All flowed immeasurably to one sea. All living forms became its atom homes. A panergy that harmonized all life held now existence in its vast control. A portion of that majesty he was made. At will he lived in the unoblivious ray. Namaste. Jai Ma.